ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland and streaming at KBOO.FM. This is Lori Mercier hosting today for the Old Mole Variety Hour, where each Monday morning we provide interviews, reviews, and views from an underground perspective. Patricia Kohlberg is our engineer. The Old Mole burrows down to the roots of the great issues of our time, the struggles of ordinary people for democratic and sustainable ways of life. Today's show focuses on matters of war and peace and how we might more creatively tackle the challenging dilemmas of our time, including how we might create political and cultural alternatives outside of capitalism and imperialism. First, I talk with S. Brian Wilson about his anti-war activism, his recent book, Don't Thank Me for My Service, and his recent reporting on the attempted U.S. coup in Nicaragua. Then Clayton Morgridge reflects on how capitalism reduces the world to just the facts and how to save the real world we love. Movie Moles Fran Michelle and I discuss the HBO miniseries Chernobyl and compare Soviet and U.S. responses to nuclear disasters. And finally, Bill Resnick reports on the Yellow Vest movement in France, who they are, their politics and demands, their significance, and what might be borrowed for a similar uprising here. Well, here with us in the studio is Brian Wilson, visiting from Nicaragua. Welcome back to Portland, Brian.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming into KBOO this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Let me give you I'll try to be brief with my introduction, and then we'll talk about Nicaragua. Brian Wilson first became an anti-war activist after serving in the U.S. Air Force in Vietnam from 1966 to 1970. He became a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War and Veterans for Peace and hasn't stopped actively opposing U.S. wars. As a lawyer and writer, he has documented U.S. war crimes in nearly two dozen countries. And in his long activist history, he has participated in actions of nonviolent civil disobedience, lengthy fasts, and tax refusal, along with voluntary simplicity. On September 1, 1987, while engaged in a protest against the shipping of U.S. weapons to Central America in the context of the Contra Wars, Wilson and other members of a Veterans Peace Action team blocked railroad tracks at the Concord, California Naval Weapons Station. An approaching train did not stop and struck the veterans. Wilson was hit, ultimately losing both legs below the knees. Subsequently, he discovered that he had been identified for more than a year as an FBI domestic terrorist suspect under President Reagan's anti-terrorist task force provisions, and that the train crew that day had been advised not to stop the train. There are several documentaries about Brian Wilson's work. I recommend to listeners the 2016 documentary, Paying the Price for Peace, the story of S. Brian Wilson and other activists. And he's authored several books, two of which we want to talk about today, Don't Thank Me for My Service, My Vietnam Awakening to the Long History of U.S. Lies, just published last year, and as a co-author of the recent collection Live from Nicaragua, Uprising or Coup. And Brian, this new collection, Live from Nicaragua, published by the Alliance for Global Justice, and people can download the PDF there on the website, Alliance for Global Justice, and I think actually a lot of anti-war sites have that available. And that collection upends the narrative that everyone heard last year about the U.S. coup attempt in Nicaragua, of course, which the U.S. media and even much of the media on the left portrayed as this democratic uprising against the autocratic Daniel Ortega. Now, you've been living in Nicaragua, and of course, you've been actively involved in the country opposing U.S. intervention since the 1980s. Tell us what happened or what's actually been happening there?
Well, the attempted coup broke out on April 18th, 2018, with a blitzkrieg of what we now think were millions of sites, WhatsApp sites, Facebook sites that were purchased. And I don't understand how all these platforms work and how the algorithms work, but there was a script, you know, pretty much the U.S. neoliberal State Department script talking about a repressive government, how they massacre their citizens and don't have any free press, and they need to be removed. That script went out all over the world with a click of a mouse, and social media as well as corporate media just kind of repeated the script. And the script, which was somewhat similar to the script that the United States promoted for Syria and Libya and in the past and still currently in Syria and in Venezuela and so forth, is the new kind of the new template for humanitarian intervention, which ironically a lot of the NGOs get on board promoting these overthrows or what we call regime changes. So the church is involved, the NED is involved, National Endowment for Democracy, U.S. Agency for International Development is involved. When I say the church, I mean the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, which has always been supporting the rich for 500 years in Latin America, and the rich, and the ex-Somocista and ex-Contras from the 80s. They all represent a small cabal of wealthy people who want to regain power so that they can privatize everything and keep the money for themselves. That's basically what happens. And initially, there was a lot of confusion because the news was overwhelmingly saying that the dictator Ortega must go, he's repressive. And they, I believe, the perpetrators and the NED and the U.S. Embassy, I believe, all believed that with the millions of money they had, dollars they had behind them, they were going to be successful in a very short period of time because that blitzkrieg of information, the narrative, was so predominant in day after day after day in social media and in corporate media. Only those of us who lived in Nicaragua knew that this was all a fake. It was not true. And I was shocked. And so I and 23 other people started putting together who live in and around Nicaragua, in Nicaragua in various parts, or visit Nicaragua many months each year. We started saying, we got to antidote this with what we now know from being on the ground in Nicaragua, what really was happening, and realizing that this is kind of the U.S. template for how regime change works. Humanitarian intervention then becomes adopted by the NGOs, including Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, of course NED, that's its function. But it's very shocking to realize that the facts don't seem to matter. The narrative matters. And I'm a trained lawyer, so I'm trained to develop evidence that supports a particular position. And since Vietnam, I have realized that much of what my government told me and what my Sunday school teachers told me and what my parents told me and what my community told me was not correct about Vietnam. That was my first real experience with lying, how lying works. So I was very conservative, and I had no I didn't even know what an activist was. I was just going to be a good lawyer and make money and live happily ever after in the American dream, when in the 60s you could still kind of conceive of that for yourself as a white male. The late 60s, no, but the early 60s, it was a piece of cake. That life was great in the United States. So when I realized that I couldn't trust what the government was saying, and then I couldn't trust what much of the media was saying, I had to join other people that I was meeting in the 70s, that we have to kind of regroup and For me, I had to relearn history. I actually had an obsession with learning the details of ancient history, European history, American history, world history, because it's the context that's so important in understanding what's happening in the moment, because the moment has a lot of things preceding it that kind of guide what's happening in the moment, especially by the politicians. So,
And that's partly what motivated you to write this book, Don't Thank Me for My Service.
Right.
Really reflecting back on your Vietnam years and how that shaped your view of history and how the realities on the ground actually altered, well, plus all the activism at the time, altered your
right.
way of thinking. And so this book, Don't Thank Me for My Service, really is a sweeping view of U.S. history, which is a history of imperialism and violence around the world.
The first third of the book is a radical history of the United States going back to the 1600s. And then that leads into a long piece on the Cold War, because the indoctrination that I grew up with was so overwhelmingly convincing that there was an enemy that was going to take away our freedoms. And we had to be vigilant to make sure we could preserve our freedoms with this enemy lurching everywhere. I thought there was a communist in every town and every closet, practically. But in my little farming community, everybody thought that way. This was in the 50s. But the indoctrination was almost cult-like. I mean, it's overwhelming. I wanted to understand why it was so easy for me, who was supposedly a good student, to obey orders to go 10,000 miles away with weapons and training to kill people. I didn't even know them. I didn't know their history. So it occurred to me, and while I was in the military, and especially in Vietnam, that the conditioning that I had experienced was so intense. And I was a representative, typical of the society, that how is it that some men knew this was not a valid policy to be obedient to? I didn't have a clue, really, and that it's kind of shameful in a way, and I'm still living with the fact that I participated in a murder machine, thinking that this was the patriotic thing to do, when in fact it was, I was a mercenary. We were mercenaries. We were murderers. We were arrogant, you know, American, U.S. Americans. So realizing all that is what's been the foundation for my activism, but I wasn't planning to be an activist. I was drafted out of law school. I was going to do my military service and become a lawyer. I did become a lawyer after the military, but I was so different in my views, I couldn't even follow the protocol of the courtroom, and I left the law very early.
Well, that critical thinking and activism since the 1960s led you to relocate to Nicaragua a couple of years ago, but just in the little time that we have here, let's talk more about why this hegemony in the media, this refusal to really recognize what was happening on the ground, and also just compared to other Central American countries. I mean, since 2006, is it, when the Sandinistas regained power?
2007, yeah.
What had actually been happening in Nicaragua compared to its neighbors in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala?
You mean before 2006?
No. Just...
Well, now everybody in Nicaragua has health care. Everybody has education. There's almost continuous, uninterrupted electricity everywhere. There's roads into the most remote areas now. Virtually all women get zero interest loans if they want to start a small business. It's the gender equity in Nicaragua is 50-50. It's the law. It's certainly the most progressive country in Central America, and certainly one of the most in all of Latin America. Maybe Bolivia and Uruguay are also very progressive. That's why those countries are targeted, because they're examples of how people can move away from obedience to the imposed neoliberal model that the U.S. wants, with all their cohorts in the oligarchic structures of all those countries that are always in cahoots with the Catholic Church, by the way, historically. So, for me, Nicaragua represents a more humane culture, far more progressive than the United States, far safer than the United States, violence, despite what the media says. And unfortunately, I still am struggling with my Spanish, so I'm not a very good learner of another language, and I'm 78 now, so it probably makes it even all the more difficult to learn another language.
The point is that Nicaragua hasn't had the violence that its neighbors, El Salvador,
right.
has actually kept out much of the drug trafficking and violence that
I'm very
has,
adamant about it.
And who don't really represent many of the migrants at the U.S. border.
Small number, very small number.
But that's something else, the media has not looked at the context
for
the migrants who have been forced to flee some
Correct.
Of these other...
They miss it all the time. There's five major corporations that own all the media, or 98% of the media. The print media, the TV media, the radio media, the Hollywood media, basically. So those five or six corporations, basically, they're part of the script. They're part of the neoliberal script, and that's how they make their money. And that's why alternative media is so important, like Habu and Gray Zone and Consortium News and so forth, because we can't depend upon the corporate media. We can't depend upon them at all.
And, of course, that corporate media is tied in with the social media, as you described,
right.
in this 21st century coup
That's right.
that social media assisted.
It's shocking to me. I couldn't believe that a lot of my left friends from the 80s support these regime change operations that the U.S. is orchestrating around the world. What? How about regime change in the U.S.? Who's going to suggest that, and who's going to organize that? I mean, we don't have any moral or legal authority to tell anybody anything.
Well, Brian Wilson, I thank you so much for coming into KBOO today, and we want to tell listeners that you will be at the Friends Meeting House tonight on Stark at 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. That's Brian Wilson at the Friends Meeting House at 7 p.m. tonight, and also urge people to check out Wilson's contributions all over the web, but also in the collection from the Alliance for Global Justice, Live from Nicaragua, Uprising or Coup, which will provide much more detailed analysis, factual analysis of what has been happening in Nicaragua the last year, and also encourage people to check out Brian Wilson's book, Don't Thank Me for My Service. Thanks again, Brian.
Thank you for having me.
Just speaking with Brian Wilson, a pacifist legend, activist, former Portland resident, now in Nicaragua, who will be speaking tonight at the Friends Meeting House at 7 p.m. And now here is the Mole's Clayton Morgridge, questioning the mantra, just the facts, and how to save the real world we love.
Just the facts, ma'am, is what Sergeant Friday, played by Jack Webb, used to say on the old police show Dragnet. He said this to witnesses when investigating a crime in order to head off their emotional reactions to what they had seen or their speculation about causes and motives. Some philosophers, logical positivists in particular, put forward the idea that the real world consists only of facts, that our feelings about the world are merely subjective and have no bearing on truth, except perhaps truths about human psychology. Facts are objective and real. Feelings are subjective and not real in any way that counts. But what could be more real than the tension in a difficult relationship, or the love between people in love, or between parents and their children? Try to convey these feelings and the way they shape what goes on between people in purely factual terms. Here's another thing whose reality is undeniable, that would not even exist except for what goes on within us. Describe what you've just heard in objective, factual terms. You could describe the sounds in great detail as wave patterns in the air. You could discuss the pitches and the tempos. But what makes what you heard music is what happens within us as we hear those sounds. When we listen to music with full appreciation, we let the rhythms and melodies play through our bodies. We ourselves become part of the music. We are moved by it. Apart from our feeling it, music is nothing. Without listeners, music would be mere sound and fury, signifying nothing. Music stirs us to our depths, engaging our emotions, and even the emotions we don't have names for. The same is true of the visual arts. They are made to be seen by living human beings who respond deeply in their bodies and souls to what they see. But isn't this true of the whole world we live in and are part of? We respond to the world not just as terrain we must find our way around in and manipulate to give us what we need. If we are fully alive, we are always responding to what is going on around us aesthetically and emotionally, with hope, fear, desire, disgust, love, and hate, and whatever emotion we are expressing when we say, "That's beautiful." The world would not be the world we know if it were not for the complex feelings involved in our encounter with it, any more than a Bob Dylan song or Beethoven's Fifth Symphony would be what we know them to be if we did not respond to them as we do. Nor, of course, would Dylan or Beethoven have created them. Yet it is not only philosophers like the logical positivists who can be seduced by the idea that the real world consists of nothing but facts that are entirely independent of human feelings. In fact, this idea is like a defense mechanism many of us employ to get along in a capitalist society. Why? Well, because capital has but one way of thinking about and acting in the world, and that is to expropriate and exploit it, to turn it into a singular unit of value, namely money. Bankers and landlords cannot see breathing, living men and women and children with needs for safe shelter. Health insurance and pharmaceutical companies cannot really see the injured and the sick. Apple and Amazon cannot see the human beings that work for them. Capital can see only sources of income and units manufactured and delivered. Capital can see nothing it can care for except opportunities for growth. Everything on earth becomes a resource for the production of profit. Forests, prairies, mountains, rivers and oceans, and all the living beings in them are fodder for the capitalist machine that chews it all up and excretes one substance, money. So when we look at our world, including each other, from within the system of capitalism, what is most real is just the facts. By what machinery and at what cost can oil be extracted from this or that seabed? And what is its value on the market? How many hours can we employ these workers at what wages to maximize our profits? How much timber can be cut in this old-growth forest? At what cost and what return on investment? Just the facts, ma'am, and don't give me irrelevant subjective feelings about the natural world or the quality of people's lives. Yes, the beauty of the world and the love that people have for each other, those are fine for leisure time and vacation, as long as they don't get in the way of production. The world that consists of facts and just the facts, the world is conceived by logical positivism and seized and governed by capital, is a thin, cold, and colorless world. It is like music that evokes no pleasure, human life without passion, a tale told by an idiot, lacking even sound and fury, and signifying nothing but death. It is a world where the impulse to love struggles to find anything worth loving, or anything to call beautiful, where our desire for love must be content with the imaginary realms of fiction, art sequestered in museums, and nature fenced off in preserves. Capitalism would blind us to everything that could evoke our love and our pleasure, to most of what impels us to say, "That's beautiful." The movement to do away with capitalism and to reconstruct the world, to make the world our world, a human world, is underway and needs our support and active participation. There is a world beyond the world of facts that we can cultivate together, guided by our desire for what can be loved because it is beautiful. I am Clayton Morgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
You're listening to KBOO Portland and the Old Mole Variety Hour. We just heard Clayton Morgridge, and here are the Movie Moles reviewing the recent and very popular HBO series, Chernobyl.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle and Laurie Mercier here to discuss Chernobyl, the 5-episode HBO miniseries that became the highest-rated TV series ever, according to IMDb. Written by Craig Mazin and directed by Johan Renck, the miniseries about the 1986 nuclear power plant disaster in the Soviet Union has an international but non-American cast and a haunting soundtrack by Icelandic composer Hildur that incorporates sounds recorded at an actual nuclear power plant. The settings and props likewise emphasize rigorous authenticity, and the cinematography and acting are superb. More controversial are the series' elements of dramatic license and questions of political interpretation.
And that's what I think we want to talk about, Fran. Of course, the opposition to the series has come from the right, predictably, upset over such a frank portrayal of the horrors of the Chernobyl accident. And many, such as in Forbes magazine, have, of course, defended nuclear power. And some have even argued that whether it was Chernobyl or Fukushima or Three Mile Island, that very few casualties resulted as a consequence of these nuclear disasters. And so those critics on the right think that Mazin and the series have used hyperbole in terms of demonstrating the dramatic consequences of the nuclear catastrophe. Now, Mazin himself has actually defended nuclear power and claims that the series is not a critique of nuclear power, but rather that the Soviet system and flawed individuals in refusing or covering up the actual disaster made matters worse. And so it was this society of secrecy and authoritarianism that brought about the Chernobyl catastrophe. And Mazin and others have also used the series to critique the climate change deniers, praising scientists. In fact, I think that's a main message of the series, is that scientists should be listened to, that science offers a great deal in terms of how we might remedy disasters such as Chernobyl. And of course, the subtext is that we need to heed scientists' warnings about climate change. And then on the left, there's been a critique of this binary, of these two opposing interpretations of the series. I think many on the left see this critique of Soviet totalitarianism as extreme, and especially in this moment of where we need a concerted effort, whether state-based or internationally based, we need this collective, collaborative, cooperative, concerted effort to remedy the climate catastrophe that we're living through. And so many on the left see this series as giving socialism a bad name at the moment where we really need socialism to address the challenges that we face.
And conversely, there are some on the right who think that what it does really well is show how evil socialism and communism are. And in both of those cases, there's an assumption that socialism or communism or the Soviet Union are all the same thing. There's only one problem here. It's that other system. And I think Mazin's comments also seem to lean in that direction, that the problem was the Soviet system, as though we don't have these problems in capitalism.
However, I think that there is a different way of reading the series, that it's one of those rare opportunities to see what Soviet life might have been like. And certainly with all the films since the Cold War, we've been given this kind of single vision of this totalitarian society. But the series, I think, actually humanizes the Soviet people, and especially the residents of Pripyat who have to deal with this catastrophe, how they cope with radiation poisoning, how they mount an incredible response in terms of mitigating the disaster, how they mobilize people or evacuate people, how they demonstrate concern for one another, even at the risk of their own personal lives and health. So I think despite Mazin's claim that it's the system that brings about this horrible catastrophe, that in reality, as we watch the residents respond, we see great humanity and bravery and kindness, and that there are some benefits to this collective cooperative society.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, having 1,000 buses sent in for the evacuation project. You know, that would be handy in New Orleans right about now. But we also have talked about the way that the Soviet system is portrayed in the show being, to some extent, a renewal of the Cold War, anti-Russia feeling. Some viewers have pointed out that there are a number of points in the series where somebody threatens to shoot somebody unless they're going to do something, when, in fact, at that point in the Soviet Union, you didn't have to threaten to shoot anybody. Everybody had already internalized and learned how to work within this system.
And certainly that's not unique to the Soviet system. I mean, we could look at any kind of American response. Look at recent wars and how it's quite amazing throughout the lies that various policymakers continue to dish out, that Americans continue to respond and obey and support those kinds of illegal actions and atrocities. Filmmaking doesn't really portray hegemony very well. It's difficult when you have to feature individuals and characters to demonstrate the way a system works to compel people to behave in a certain way, that threatening to shoot someone is a much more effective way of communicating that kind of obedience.
One of the things that some people have criticized the series for is the invention of a singular scientific character played by Emily Watson, in place of the dozens and hundreds of scientists who actually worked on this project. And the effect of making her this sort of heroic figure is we get the dauntless scientist pursuing truth against the will of the authorities, which makes it much more dramatic. It gives us someone we're rooting for, but it also massively oversimplifies the way that people operate within hegemonic systems, whether state capitalist or old-fashioned capitalist or neoliberal capitalist. There is a lot more complexity than can be placed into the formulas of HBO narrative.
And kind of a reifying scientist. That's, I guess, a critique that I have of the series, is that it emphasizes so much heroic efforts of scientists without critiquing the role of scientists in creating the monster. And that's been kind of interesting following the reviews as well. So many science groups, Union of Concerned Scientists and PSR, others have praised the role of scientists in this climate of climate science denial. I think it's a bit misplaced to lionize scientists too much, but nonetheless, there is this context of science deniers that I think maybe the filmmakers were trying to put more emphasis on that.
The show's creator, Craig Mazin, has also stressed the importance of telling the truth and listening to science in some of his statements about the program outside of it.
And also just underscoring the real dangers of nuclear power. And certainly at this moment, many people who are actively working as climate justice activists have actually come out to support nuclear power as an alternative. It creates no carbon gases and so on. But of course, Greenpeace and other anti-nuclear activists remind us that it's an extremely polluting and dangerous form of energy when there are so many other alternative, cleaner alternative forms of energy available. And I think when we were talking about whistleblowers and the scientist in Chernobyl who represents many other scientists, I was reminded of Karen Silkwood. Silkwood's case, the film that was created about her life in 1983, is another great film that reminds us of an earlier time of concern about nuclear power and the dangers of nuclear production. In that film, and in Karen Silkwood's life, as she tried to raise the alarm about dangers of Kerr-McGee, I think those supporters and critics of the Chernobyl series forget that regardless of whether it's a Soviet state or capitalist state, these kinds of cover-ups have occurred.
Some of the defenders of nuclear power in relation to this series point out that the kind of reactor that they used at Chernobyl is no longer in use. It was a particularly dangerous design. But although Chernobyl is often described as the worst nuclear disaster ever, there have been plenty of others. And there's some debate these days about, well, maybe Fukushima is worse than Chernobyl. And that one comes from a reactors designed by GE. And it's still in use around the United States, around the world. There are all kinds of dangers associated with nuclear power, and the secrets are not just kept by the bad Russians. Thinking about this show and doing some research on the history of nuclear power, I learned about the Santa Susana, California nuclear accident in 1959, which happened near Los Angeles, and nobody mentioned anything about it for 2 months, and then they said, no, not a big deal, but in fact, it released more radiation than Three Mile Island. It's the worst disaster in the U.S., and we don't hear a lot about it. There are also, of course, other kinds of disasters that we don't hear enough about.
And the China Syndrome, another very popular film in 1979, was based on research of nuclear accidents in the United States. So that film, interestingly, was released in 1979, just a couple of months before the Three Mile Island accident. So in the late 70s and early 80s, when Silkwood and the China Syndrome were released, there was this kind of heightened attention to the dangers of nuclear production and more concerns about corporate cover-ups, which those films and the real events behind those films actually documented.
And those things have not improved. Although the particular kind of reactor used at Chernobyl is not in use, that doesn't mean that nuclear power is safe. And despite what Mazin comments about this series, I think the effect of it has been for most viewers to realize that nuclear power is really, really dangerous. So although it is something that kind of goes politically in different directions insofar as there are people concerned about climate change who think that nuclear power might be a better alternative, I think that that's a view that doesn't take account of the tremendous dangers of nuclear power, some of which are graphically, perhaps overdramatically, but still reasonably dramatically represented in this series.
And we begin with a political critique of the film from right and left. And I think we might return to that because certainly in looking at the dangers of nuclear power today and the threats that we all face as humanity on this planet, we have to think about some system, some democratic participatory system that will allow us to address the threats of climate change and other disasters that are waiting for us. And socialism certainly seems like a more reasonable alternative than leaving decision-making in the hands of these corporate power brokers.
Corporate power brokers, Soviet apparatchiks, totalitarian dictators, none of these people should be in charge. there's also a sort of left reading of this series that sees it as indicting and showing the problems of Stalinism, not of socialism in general. The problem is this hierarchical system, which is in a lot of ways like capitalism, but with healthcare.
Well, what do you think, Fran? Do we recommend this series?
Well, if you have access to HBO, if it comes your way, sure. I think there are also other stories about nuclear power and disasters and Chernobyl that might be also worth considering. You can find the film The China Syndrome and the film Silkwood at the Multnomah County Library on DVD. You can find some of the books that Mazin used in developing the series also at the library, including Voices from Chernobyl, which is an oral history. So those are also available as resources for people thinking about these questions.
And that's it for the Old Mole Variety Hour. This has been Laurie Mercier and Fran Michel reviewing the HBO series Chernobyl. That was music from the TV series Chernobyl that Fran Michel and I just reviewed. And here is Bill Resnick with his commentary about the Yellow Vest movement in France.
Okay, folks, from Chernobyl, pretty ominous. You may not have missed it. That's the French national anthem. I think I should read the chorus that goes like this. Quite amazing. To arms, citizens, form your battalions. Let's march, let's march. Let the tyrant's blood water our furrows. You don't hear that on TV so much anymore. Wow, the French, all those bourgeoisie who can afford a ticket, they sing that at soccer matches and rock concerts. Well, there you go. People are complicated. And the French Revolution and also the Paris Commune, they live, but not necessarily as daily activity. Except maybe the yellow vests that I've been reading about. A huge insurrectionary movement in France rose unexpected, now 6 months old, not stopping. At the beginning, having 80% public support, it's now down because of the violence, most instigated by provocateurs of the right. Like in Portland, it gives the police justification for immense repression. In France, so far, 2,000 people have been seriously wounded, 23 blinded with rubber bullets, but still 60% of the French support the Yellow Vests. 60%. Who are the Yellow Vests? Well, when the government, the French government, a new government, headed by a dashing young charismatic banker who sounded like he wanted to really change things, Hope, turned out to be more a banker than a change agent. He lowered taxes on the rich, raised taxes on gasoline, also on pensions, reduced housing assistance, allowed the just privatized railroads to raise fares. Well, that was a lot of insults, and the Yellow Vests erupted all over France, especially in the countryside, whose cities are depopulating, of course. People are getting poorer and older, though still a lot of young folks with families, and they all need gasoline to get around and practice their occupations. So they rose up, communicating through the internet all over France. They began congregating and knew each other. They made a great sight with their yellow vests. I should explain, every French car is required to have a yellow vest. It's like a seatbelt in the United States. The French have to wear them if they go out to repair their car. It apparently cuts down on a lot of deaths on the highway. Anyway, all those yellow vests began to occupy, let me emphasize, occupy the roundabouts and city centers, occupying them with marches every week and growing. In addition, their demands and organizations were not just around bread and butter issues. They demanded that Macron, the banker, resign. They called for an initiative for the right to propose a law to recall representatives, and also to have control over them, and also to change the Constitution. That had not been discussed since the revolution that established the Paris Commune in 1871, actual people power. Further, Trahan-Dott pointed out, and I'm quoting, "We should note that the symbolism of the French Revolution has been ever-present in the Yellow Vest movement. The national anthem, Marseillaise, is often sung, not as a nationalist melody, but as a revolutionary song. Likewise, the French flag is often carried in the demonstrations. On some traffic circles, effigies of Macron are decapitated, as King Louis XVI was in 1793, and he richly deserved it. Finally, the Yellow Vests have compiled books of grievances." That's a term from 1789. Yes, to the barricades, comrades. Well, I just wanted to wake you up and remind you, we're talking about the Yellow Vest movement in France, a real popular uprising still happening. In April, a National Assembly of 200 Yellow Vest collectives, it issued a statement. Here's the statement. "We call upon all regions of the country to collectively fight for the satisfaction of our demands regarding social issues, taxes, the environment, and democracy. Aware that we have to combat a global system, we believe that we must get out of capitalism. The power of the people, by the people, for the people. Don't just watch, join us. By the people and for the people." Well, there was another revolution. Trahan-Dott concludes his essay in New Politics. He asks, "Where is France going? Are the seeds of a new French Revolution just beginning to appear? Born out of a fight about an unjust tax, the movement of the Yellow Vests has provoked a long-lasting social and political crisis. Now the entire system has been called into question. A new social consciousness and political collectivity is appearing. In the dynamic of the movement, the Yellow Vests seem more and more to be a new popular power that demands to control the public power of the government and that insists on controlling its own destiny. That's for 6 months they've been in the streets, bedeviling the French government. Behind the demands, a project for a new society has appeared. That's Trihandot's line. The class struggle is back in France. Well, yes, yes. Perhaps, which raises another question, is it possible that they could be joined by the underclass in this country? Well, maybe. Never say never. Surely there are signs that the times are a-changing. Here, too. Anyway, this is Bill Resnick on the Yellow Vest movement in France. Viva la Revolution.
Bill, viva la Revolution. And is there a possibility that in this country, Occupy, the voices of Occupy, could educate the Tea Party?
Well, you know, I did miss a page in my script, didn't I? Your question was, it could affect the Tea Party, yes. The Tea Party and the corporate Republicans are really at loggerheads, and there was a period when they were defeating them in elections. A number of Tea Party people have moved towards the Democrats because they thought that the Democrats had a better line. They'll learn soon that it's as corporate as Republicans. Yes, I think so. There's tremendous anxiety and willingness to think about alternatives out there.
And so it's a matter of progressives reaching out to people who could potentially be mobilized, who are momentarily distracted or misled by their sort of xenophobia, racism, and blaming the wrong culprits for their anxieties.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's reaching out to the people, but it's not just convincing them of something, because people have, you know, often contradictory consciousness. So you can sort of convince them one day, and the next day the next person comes along and says, look at these facts. And they move back and forth. And it's hard. They don't have time to really, you know, we have a lot of time to read and stuff, and most people don't. They're involved in millions of things, including race. You know. So what we need are sort of facts on the ground in some ways. We need the institutions like KABU, for example, where people operate democratically and develop those values. And a lot of that is happening in the United States. There's all of this ferment, it seems to me, at levels to create this sort of alternative world.
But you find in the Yellow Vest movement this kind of potential, how a symbol helped galvanize people around this critique of neoliberalism and Macron.
Yes, you know, it's interesting, the page that I somehow skipped. Well, you know, it's not perfect. KABU's not perfect, but we're still the best radio in the world. It's a low bar, unfortunately. But we're terrific. But the page that I skipped, there was critique that because they didn't like the gas tax, that they were for climate change or something, and they came up with a slogan, end the monthly hunger, end the end of the world. And the idea was, and the same people who make us hungry at the end of the month are also ending the world. And they're very pro doing something about climate change. Anyway, yes, there's really ferment out there.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. Bill Resnick. Of the Old Mole Variety Hour. This is Lori Mercier, your host today, and we want to thank Brian Wilson especially for coming in and reporting on the U.S. coup in Nicaragua. He'll be speaking tonight at the Friends Meeting House at 7 p.m. And we also want to thank Fran Michel, Clayton Morgeridge and Patricia Kohlberg for putting the show together, for their contributions today. And as always, you can subscribe to or listen to the Old Mole podcast by going to our page on the KBOO website. And you can also find there links to past shows and segments with further links to even more useful information, including how to follow and contact us. The Old Mole Variety Hour will be back next Monday at 9 a.m. And stay tuned to Locus Focus and hear more about the Zenith Energy's crude oil terminals.